Thank you all. This is the user panel for ALM. I'm going to let our panelists introduce themselves in a moment. I'm going to say that we have a really great variety here in terms of experience of ALM usage and geographic spread. And a style of usage in terms of specializations of disciplines. And I'm hoping that although I've prepared a cheat sheet of questions, this becomes your session as well. So Keith is in the room with microphones. And I'll kick it off. I've got some questions prepared that you've suggested in advance. But this is going to work as well. If you raise your hand, I'll be looking for you, and Keith will be looking for you in the back. And you can chime in, and we'll make this as interactive as you choose to interact. So let's start. We'll go from we'll start with Rob, who's here next to the podium, and just go across and. And if each of you would just, you know, give a brief introduction of, you know, your background with ALM, where you're from, what you've done, so everyone gets a feeling for you in your own words. Rob, would you do the honors?
Sure. Hi, I'm Rob Mayer from New Zealand. I've been working with ALM since 2005, maybe, predominantly with financial services organizations in New Zealand, so banks, insurance companies, some telcos. Yeah, that's me.
Hi, my name's Deborah Forsyth. I'm from Toronto, Canada. I am a consultant. I do most of my consulting through a company called Object Sharp. We're a gold partner with Microsoft. I specialize in testing. I am an ALM MVP, but majority of the work I do is with test teams, coaching for Agile, and that's pretty much it.
Hi, my name is Michael Surface. I'm a solutions architect for Boeing, which has been talked about a few times here at this conference. I've been in the ALM space since TFS 2005, and we were basically looking for a replacement for VSS and came across TFS, and then I wanted to figure out what this was, and so we started using it from a kind of a server under my desk to then 2008 came out. We put a VM in the data center, and now with our 2010 instance, we have over 100 server farm in another data center, and then that's our kind of our enterprise offering. We're definitely growing in the ALM space. So we have the service, we have the infrastructure in place. Our biggest challenge right now is the kind of the education and the evangelizing of how to use the tools to take full advantage of it.
Yeah, hi, I'm Martin. I'm working for Siemens in Germany. So this is one of the largest engineering and also software companies in the world. We started introducing application lifecycle management in 2009. And my job is working as a program manager to introduce ALM, mainly based on Team Foundation Server, to various R&D and IT units of all sizes and geographic distribution in our company.
So I'd like to kick it off with a question that came up yesterday when we were chatting over lunch with. What do you see as the greatest benefit of ALM adoption? I think one of you used the phrase are your customers really getting the gold out of what they've got?
So, I mean, I'll take that one first. From my point of view, I go into organizations and I see they have some great process set up, all the teams potentially using their ALM tooling, and they're religiously entering this data in. You know, all of the teams are interacting really well. And I go in and say, great, you know, what are you getting out of it? Okay, I can see your micro data, your sprint burn down charts, or your number of defects, you know, that you've produced in this sprint if you're using an agile process. But what about the macro data? What are you getting better? How much is it costing you? you know, are you getting better as a shipping organization? And that's often when you get the blank looks. So for me, the gold is all of that combined integrated data that, sorry, Sam, isn't easy to get at sometimes, and you need to involve some people like us. It could be made a little easier. But that's really what the promise of ALM is for me, is pulling that data out, getting the dashboards for the execs and saying, hey, here's how your delivery organization is running. Here's areas that you need to focus on in order to improve.
And I'd like to add to that because, so our enterprise offering was really funded because our executives wanted to see that data, that goal that was supposed to come out. And so the issue that we're having is that we have several layers in between the line managers that are sort of running these teams and the executives that are expecting this kind of return on investment. And it's not always communicated that, you know, we should be following these processes. And Boeing being a very large company, many different types of projects, some projects, especially on the defense side, require CMMI, lots of checks and balances. I'm actually on the commercial side in the training and flight services organization where we're a lot more agile, and so we can actually adopt agile processes. But within the framework that Boeing has set up, we still have kind of these common processes that they want us to all follow. And so we've customized our TFS templates so that we start collecting that data. The problem is we're not all doing every piece of it. So we're either doing just source control, or we're doing requirements management, or some more project management, or we're just doing test case. We're using MTM for the test case suite, but we're using other tools for our sprint planning and our source management. And so we're definitely a heterogeneous environment. And so what we're hoping to get is as the usability of our sort of our enterprise offering, hopefully with TFS 11, we're definitely on board with putting that in as soon as possible, that it'll become easier for people to use and we'll actually be able to start collecting these metrics so that we can actually then act on them. And that's kind of the promise that we see in the tool, but we haven't realized it yet.
The team side of things, of people actually using the tool, I think collaboration is probably one of the biggest benefits that teams are getting from TFS.
Yeah, we see those integrated workflows across disciplines. So requirements engineers working together with developers, with architects, with testers, everybody having access to the same data. So a colleague of mine likes to say it's the truth inside the project repository, if we talk TFS, and it gives some kind of fun back to development. Yeah? So, for example, in the healthcare area, it's a regulated area, we have to follow difficult processes, and the number of rules grew and grew over the years. It became very complicated for new guys to get educated. And now you can shape your rules into automated workflows, and this makes life much easier from the process manager's point of view and also from the user's point of view. And then regarding the managers, yeah, we did several return on invest calculations, and they were very favorable. It showed if you focus on certain practices like, say, backlog management, it will be an immediate return on invest within a few months. And looking at larger stuff like configuration and build management in a huge organization distributed among continents, it may take 2 years or so, but you can calculate it. And so it's very favorable also from a manager's point of view.
You've alluded to the idea that one of the things that you need is to get the data up, and that involves pulling in members of the team beyond just developers narrowly defined as programmers. And I'm wondering about your experiences there. Deborah, I know you've come from a test QA background. What have been, and Michael, you mentioned, you know, use of MTM. I'm wondering what all of your experiences are with regard to your ability to use ALM as a means to pull others into a self-managing collaborative team. Deborah, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. It can be difficult. I think one of the biggest pieces that companies miss out on is actually training before they implement TFS to their teams. Testers, you know, can be very nervous. We have to realize that, you know, Microsoft did a survey a few years back, and I think it was 80 or 70% of testers are still, you know, basic manual testers. So they don't have coding skills to go in and be able to do unit testing with a developer. So they get very nervous with this whole idea of being agile and the tools and how they work. But once they get a feel for it, you know, when they see what gets put into a bug these days through the ALM tool and the information that, you know, they haven't had to gather and maybe verbally explain to a developer. I think the biggest one, and I actually teach for the testing tools, and the big one that I love to tell them all about is that they're never going to see a bug come back that says, you know, I can't reproduce this. So, you know, there's a learning curve, but once they get past that learning curve and if they've had some training and, you know, not just on the tools but on the process, whether it's agile or agile, I call it agile, but a form of agile, even if it's waterfall, they see the benefits very quickly. But it can be difficult, especially when you're getting into where testers are, you know, working with a developer. And that's one of the things that I push myself big time is, you know, we need to get the testers working alongside of a developer and getting some really good unit tests coming out because, you know, you're the cost of it, and we all know all the stories behind getting your testing done earlier. And one situation that we've had that we work with is we get these manual testers, and, you know, they're all good testers. They just don't know how to code. And we have them, you know, do a spreadsheet of all the things that they would test against a user story, sit down with the developer, go through that list, and either the developer and tester pair up for writing the unit test, so the tester then is getting some experience of seeing how a unit test is written, or leave the list with the developer. The developer then can check off all the ones that they actually had a unit test for, share that with the tester, and eventually, I know myself, eventually the longer I sit with a developer watching them create unit tests, I can actually do it without having a development background. So, you know, there's a lot to the tool for, I think, all teams, but especially the testers. I think it's a big curve.
I think from my point of view with the test teams, Deborah's right. MTM, it needs a bit of training. You need a bit of help to get started. But one of the biggest hooks I've found in the product for helping people into that, specifically with TFS, is, you know, the build management, actually understanding what's in a build. So instead of this, well, we've given you a build, and they get something thrown over it, and, well, where's the release notes? What's fixed? What should we be testing? The stuff missing? You know, actually enforcing that build process. And testers love that. You know, agile or waterfall, really doesn't matter. Having certainty about what's in this build I'm looking at, being able to pull the next build when they're ready, and understand, well, I've got a mix of new features and bug fixes, and the tool is explaining to me what's in there at any point in time. So for me, that's been a really good hook to bring in the testers into that process.
I mean, from our perspective, the actual tester role is something that's been an afterthought, and we're now recognizing that we actually need dedicated resources, and we're filling those positions because leaving it up to the developers to make sure it's been tested. You know, our definition of done definitely can use some improvement. it's just there's just so much to do, and so that it's kind of an afterthought. But we recognize it, and we're trying to fix it.
Yeah, so this integrated tool environment helps to make testers part of the team. So in certain org units, we used to have dedicated test teams on different test levels, and team sizes were decreased, and we created interdisciplinary teams, so having requirements engineers, developers, and testers closely collaborating in a Scrum-like style, and this really helps to get things faster forward, have shorter iteration cycles. So iteration cycles were decreased from 6 weeks to 3 weeks, to give an example. And but then there are also the system testers who do the final product testing. They stay a group of their own. But the collaboration between those different roles really, really benefits from this common data repository, having access to the same data and having always up-to-date data. So, and then, of course, the testing infrastructure, the test steps. So we don't have too much experience with this so far, but it looks very promising just to reduce cost and test infrastructure.
Yeah, I should also add that if it's a large team, like 30 to plus, they definitely have dedicated testing resources, but it's the small teams where we get hit with small budgets, can't afford a tester, it's internal projects. But I'm still finding that the churn, the ping pong between that's not quite what we wanted, it still drives the actual cost of doing internal apps up. So we're recognizing we need to fill testers. It doesn't matter whether the project's big or small.
You mentioned definition of done as something that you're working on. I'm wondering what your experience is with definition of done and how your progression is at getting better with that, or how you feel that's going, and if you have thoughts or recommendations there.
Well, it's built into our process template. It is often overlooked. So according to the process that we've developed, it's builds, compiles, unit tests, and then test cases. So the infrastructure is set up to support that kind of definition of done, and I suppose it's delivered to the customer. In reality, it's often, it compiles, I think it's done, and then we throw it over the wall. But that's only in the small teams. In the bigger teams, I'm sure they have probably a lot bigger or better requirements for definition of done. That's about it.
So I'm a Scrum guy, so I'm going to take any opportunity to talk about anything to do with Scrum. From my point of view, teams love owning their own quality measures. There's nothing that energizes a team than that. You mean the customer doesn't own quality? We get to own quality. And so taking ownership of what it means to be finished, and it's great, I think, to have it in the process template. From my point of view, I want it on the wall. I want it somewhere loud and proud that everyone can look at it as well. And teams can look at, what's their definition of done? Oh, wow. They go through the UX sign-off as well. We should add that to ours. So anything that drives the illustration, in an area of your organization that it's a drive-by for all, as much kind of senior management as possible, I think it's great to get that up there and understand, hey, this is what we mean by potentially shippable. And I don't think that the tools necessarily help us as much as they could with that definition of done yet, and it's something I think that deserves a bit of investment while I'm spending my product dollars. So.
I hear you. Okay.
So I actually have a question for you. What would you, what usually is done to you guys? Like, is it a user story being done?
Yep. So for me, the definition of done that kind of arrives on the wall that I would put on a team wall would be, this is our feature done that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So obviously overall done is going to be acceptance criteria of our feature plus the team's definition of done.
I would have, one thing that I always kind of try to add in is that the stakeholder has a part of the decision of being done. Because they're basically, in most cases, they're the last ones to do the last review. So they, and, you know, it's something that they've asked for. And they confirm with the team that, yeah, we're done.
Yeah.
Sort of the last.
Absolutely. So they get to own that acceptance criteria to say this is what it means to me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they should be suggesting to the team, hey, yeah, should this go in your guys' definition of done? Is it something that you as a team feel you can commit
yeah.
to? You know, the more exposure that list can get outside the team, I think the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
yeah, I think having automated workflows gives you the great opportunity to apply this notion of done to individual artifacts that are completed. It may be features, it can also be test cases or test runs, or all the entities you're dealing with you find in your process template. And so in former times, we followed a process model, so high-level process with milestones like product definition, realization, testing. And milestones were months apart. So after months, you detected, oh, we were not quite done with this feature. So back to the start and do some rework on this. And there's a constant change of focus for the developers. I think it's much, much better for the developers and testers and so on to get things done closely after they really did the work. So get the approval from the product owner or whatever process you're following. If you're working in an iterative or sprint-like style, really getting rid of this and then change your focus to something new. And we try to impose a really disciplined working style. If at the end of an iteration the product owner detects that something is not quite as expected, the user story or feature will not be closed. So it's not a 95% closed. No, it will be stay open and be taken over to the next iteration. And this gives you a very clear view on where you are. So the project managers turned out to be my best friends when we started to introduce Team Foundation Server, because they immediately recognized which level of transparency they got. That's a question over there.
Let me repeat the question for the the record. So, as I understand it, it's you get a bunch of folks who are simply afraid to take ownership of saying, "Yes, I accept it's done, and I'm willing to be the one who goes on record and says, yes, we close this user story. I sign off on it. It's done." How do you overcome that fear?
So one thing I use with teams getting started is literally give them a little checklist that is their definition of done. And at the bottom one of those is going to be, you know, product owner approves. And so they literally go through each step, yes, 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 we've done all these things, and the product owner's seen it and eyeballed it and said it's fine. You know, and at that point there's a level of, well, we've done everything as a team we said we were going to do, we've got the right stakeholder approval, I can't do any more. You know, check with your teammates, is there anything else? Tick, that's it. You know, really, really basic visual aids that then they can use to go get over that, as you say, initial inertia of, what if it's wrong and someone comes back to me and says, you missed this step, and just helps them get over some of that and make that definition of done a bit of muscle memory that becomes sort of, you know, easily repeatable.
Yeah, I'd agree that I think it needs to be a team decision so that it's not one person feeling like they're taking the responsibility. You know, everybody's responsible for the quality now, so everybody should be responsible for saying, yeah, we're done, let's close that user story. And definitely a checklist, is, especially when you're starting out, would be very helpful to ease the, you know, the fear that people might have. I haven't experienced people having fear doing it, but, you know, it's, I can see where that would, could come.
We advocate that, you know, a lot, you know, to take ownership and the team ownership. But when you walk into those new customers who are really new to the concept and they come from those traditional methodologies where there's a lot of, you know, fear of, like, even in the bug tracking systems, there's sometimes fear of closing a bug or who should close the bug, right? So I was just curious to see, you know, if you've encountered it. And those are some really good ideas about how to, you know, ease people through it.
Yeah, indeed, we built this into the process template by creating multiple lifecycle steps. So the states there, there's one state where the development team closes the work item. So let's say completed, which means implementation is completed and all the unit testing and integration stuff has been done. And afterwards, the product owner will do the acceptance, and the last stage would be the verification by the system test group. So, not talking about a larger organization having all these different roles. So it's a multi-step approach. But the final verification step is always done by the testers, and I think yeah, this is part of the tester's role and responsibility. Acceptance is done by the product owner, but the technical verification, in the end, by the testers.
And I would say for teams that are a little smaller, maybe don't have that those many steps, is you've got to have you know, your management buy-in to say, you know, if we make a mistake, we'll own up to it, but we'll recognize it, and we'll know better next time. But there's support that there's not going to be chastisement or banishment or anything like that. So it's even though they're new to the whole process, there's buy-in from our leadership and support, and also training. I mean, we don't just throw people into a process without any training. We have quite an extensive amount of training before we'll even let people use the TFS instance.
And coming from the testing background and having been for years responsible, it's great being able to share it.
I love the perspective. Keith here has a mic, so please feel free to raise your hand. And
we've also got Nino in the back, and he's got a mic. So if we get it, then it gets recorded, and your voice will be what people will hear. So you have any questions?
And while you're formulating your question, I want to ask the panel. You've alluded to. Things like Rob talked about, the power of the team owning its own definition of quality, and Martin's talked about the process template, and there's a sort of, you know, paradox or scale there. I see. How do you deal with the idea of empowering in the small to scaling in the large, and what have you? How have you dealt with these issues of scaling big and empowering small?
So maybe I'll start with that one. I'm going to come down on the give the team some flexibility side of this equation, and maybe Martin will disagree with me. Even in the impossibly large, I guess, from my point of view, it's a series of small teams, or hopefully it's a series of small teams. So again, Scrum guy. We'll think about this in terms of Scrum. And I want to make sure the team truly is self-organizing. The more you take away from them, you know, the more you're going to damage that, and the more actually you're going to encourage people to think, well, no, someone else is doing the heavy lifting for me here. I don't have to worry about this. So from my point of view, again, the gold is all in the data. So I'd rather give people the freedom and then get into that gold, get into the data, and make sure it's happening the way I need it to. And if that's not occurring, go in and do some coaching. So providing more freedom in the process template, but with some kind of reporting coming out the back, and then on-the-spot coaching where it's required, is kind of the way I look at those situations. But Martin, you may have a different viewpoint.
Yeah, so I put extensive thought into these questions. So, yeah, we have identified three types of user groups. Small, medium, and large teams. And to quantify, small teams maybe in the range up to 20 people involved, then mid-size 20 to 80, something like this, and larger teams. So our smallest team we support is just 2 developers, and the largest is about 3,000 persons involved. So we really need to scale up, and now the question comes up, how to shape the processes. Our answer is to come up with process modules. Like if you're creating a software or software-intensive product, you have some architecture behind it. You're breaking down everything into subsystems and components, which are loosely coupled, and you make them work together by some underlying architecture. And the same can be applied to processes, too. So you end up with process modules, we like to call it practices. So backlog management could be a practice. Or automated UI tests could be a practice. Or team management with Team Foundation Server could be a practice. And so we put together a whole number of those practices, and each customer can pick what fits to the individual situation. And small teams, of course, are looking for a standardized solution. Yeah, whatever you give them is better than what they used to have before. So it must be standardized, and it must be available fast. We call this offering TFS on demand. Give it to us next week, and it must be cheap. And we must be able to step in and step out quickly as circumstances require. For larger teams, it's different. They have their history and their constraints, their processes, and you have more to integrate with the existing tool landscape and create data and maybe workflow interfaces to this. So a whole lot of customizing goes into this. But we try to start with the same set of practices, implementing engineering best practices on an abstract level. In this automated tool environment. And this, so far it's running fine. We'll see how large we can scale up in the future. But this seems to be a valid approach to support various types of teams. So we try not to customize the process itself, so have a different backlog management for smaller and larger teams. We try to keep it the same.
It's kind of an interesting way of doing it because, when we did our enterprise offering, you had 2 templates to choose from. And it kind of became a barrier to entry because people would look at the more advanced agile template that had all these different phases, and they wanted to do Scrum, so they ended up using another tool. And so you end up, the tool wars, you end up with people using different systems, and that's kind of defeating the purpose. So if we can maybe adopt the Scrum template that's coming out in TFS 11 as some of the, for the very small teams that are that want to be more agile but not have the many checks and balances that are offered with the standard template, then that might work. I should also say that prior to Boeing, I did consulting for about 6 years, and we did flavors of extreme programming, and in teams of as small as 6 and as large as about 30 developers, 30 testers. And we found that the smaller teams appeared to be more nimble, but the larger team, having that testing resource definitely caught a lot of things that we wouldn't have caught normally, even though we were doing the unit testing and stuff. So I would hate to see what it's like for the 3,000 team, but
In my experience, it's mostly been, I would call them probably small teams. Definitely have not seen a 3,000 person team. Be interesting. Basically, the same as Rob, you know, self-managed teams. And, you know, one of the things that we do is coaching. So, you know, we're usually on hand to help them and let them. We had an interesting situation on one team that was new, where they had one person on their team that wasn't working out. And, of course, the first thing they came to myself and another coach and said, you know, you guys got to get this guy off our team. He's not working out. We go, no, no, no. Now, remember, we did through this training, you guys are self-managed. It's up to you to handle this guy. And it was, I kind of felt bad for them, being that they were just starting out with Agile. But it was interesting to see how they actually handled it. And it actually showed one person within the team being much more assertive than others. So the others sort of let him lead in the whole process. But it worked eventually. And the first thing, you know, as a coach, I said, you know, is there something we can do as a team to help them versus just boot them off the team? So, you know, people had to take a look at that. It was a whole different role for them. It was interesting.
I think we have someone here.
Yeah. Just a tangential question off of this. We've heard the word data used many times. You've talked about business data. We've talked about the tools leveraging data. Yesterday I saw Justin clicking off the web, getting pictures in there, audio clips in there. And also here, I heard Brian Harry talk about the challenges Microsoft had in rolling this out. So my question is, how do we start gauging the infrastructure impact, and how do we prepare for this across all the different tools that we're trying to implement here, across all the data we're collecting here, to make sure that the things we're trying to do are supported effectively underneath? Storage-wise, processing horsepower-wise?
I would say engage a consultant. That's what we do.
And Sam would say, trust, it just works.
I don't think I'd say that.
I think there's some pretty great guidance out there for, you know, not at these guys' scale, but, you know, for a standard enterprise, there's some pretty good guidance already published about what you can expect your hardware demands to be. And I found that pretty accurate. So once you get up to 3,000-person teams, I'd say call these guys. but if you're like the rest of us, I'd say the guidance actually works. Follow that, and that's probably going to cover 90% of the people out there, I think.
You don't seem to have another hand going up. You have another question in your back pocket?
Sure. So this is a great segue, actually. Not just infrastructure, but operations. Tom, yesterday in his keynote, Tom Grant talked about DevOps as something that is certainly happening. And we've talked about testers in the team. We haven't talked about operations. And certainly, it's not just about getting to working software. It's about getting the working software working and being used. And I'm curious as to your experiences pulling in operations and your interaction with operations. How have you done this? What do you do?
I think that's one of the biggest holes generally in the tooling right now and in the way people think about development and ALM. So ALM, you know, you've got the catch line at operations, and you often go in and say, great, and where are the operations guys and how do they contribute? Where do your production defects or bugs come from? Oh, we've got this, you know, bug tracking tool that the help desk uses, and never the twain shall meet. You know, the data doesn't pass between the two. And so getting people to think about what's a whole of life cost? You know, how much it costs to get it over the line into production, that's fine, that's a number. But what's your 5-year, 10-year, you know, how long is this thing going to be around? What's your whole of life cost about? That's what you need to drive down, not necessarily just the cost of production. So unless you can pull, you know, we're back to the data again, unless you can pull that information in, either using the same tooling or integrating with whatever you're using in your op space, you're not getting enough of a view. You know, you're just getting that partial picture. And more often than not, that's custom work I've found going into companies. It's just not there right now as a product. I don't know any product that is. And so it's hooking that data together somehow to get that full view. And even getting the ops teams to pull off some kind of backlog in the same way that the delivery teams are to get the same kind of ideas around cycle time and work in progress and all those important measures that we're interested in the development world, they're equally important in the ops world. So I found it a real challenge bridging the two, because right now I think there's a big gap in the thinking and the tooling just around that. What does whole of life cost look like?
I'd have to say that in my experience, they just haven't been part of the team, or, you know, it's kind of we're done, pass it off, and off it goes. The only middle piece for in most instances that I've been involved in and I recommend is having a staging environment that is as close, because you cannot ever duplicate, you know, a production environment, but is as close as you can get, and, you know, spend a bit of time before it gets implemented doing some testing there. And I just, an idea I had yesterday when we were watching one of the presentations on the tool that's coming with Dev 11, I believe. No, the other one. I can't remember the name of it, though. That they're talking about being in the ops side, running when in production, feeds back to development.
IntelliTrace in production?
Right.
Yeah.
Having that run even in a staging environment to try and catch things before it goes into production. But, yeah, I think operations should be part of the team, a representation of them on the Agile team to smooth things out.
Depends on how much pain you want to have. we have several layers of operations. We have the applications that we are the operations, and we can go into production. Well, a few of us can go into production and do make sure the configuration is set up. We know the other applications that are there. That obviously can't work across large scale. And then we have shared web servers, shared database servers. That requires a little bit more pain because you've got to plan for it. You've got to issue what we call snap records, basically planned outages, so the help desk knows in case somebody calls in. And I'm going to have to pass the Brian Harry yesterday, that pull the plug on the load balancer, because that's actually been biting us for our data center. The TFS servers have been fine, but it's the load balancer that keeps falling down. We'll see if they like that one.
Yeah, we found it to be one of the biggest challenges in introducing TFS to set up an adequate infrastructure and train the ops. So we completely underestimated this, and we learned it the hard way. We followed your advice and engaged high-end consultants to help us through this. And, this paid out. So we had experts on SQL Server, on SharePoint and everything, but not on TFS as a whole environment. And it takes just time to collect experience. There are so many things to detect. We learn every month new stuff. For example, you change your protocol from HTTP to HTTPS, so what do you have to do? Some certificate here, something there, and it takes time till it works together. So, yeah, use the consultants.
So we have a question here.
So in your experiences, have you ever run teams where your operations meet with members of your Scrum or Sprint teams, to where the operations are handling the tickets to the teams, to where that integration is incorporated daily, where the teams are the ones doing the fixes, that roll back through the process either as a part of a production support instance or rolled out in a future sprint that's being worked on?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, we've used Scrum teams that do that kind of break-fix stuff on real short iterations, and they're just fed either enhancements, maintenance work, or whatever's come out of the bug, kind of, the latest bug triage. So, yeah, they'll respond to production defects or low-impact maintenance work or, whatever else is on their current backlog. But they're in really, really tight iterations because, obviously, it's a lot of interrupt-type work.
Quite often when there's, in my experience, when there is a company support team for the product maybe being built, what we always set up a system. And actually what we did is they were using a different ticketing system. We got them using TFS, and we did some fancy customization to work item for them. So, you know, when they put a ticket in, there was a estate that actually meant an assignment to the test team who verified that it really was a bug or not. If it was, you know, sometimes it was just training, different things. But then if it was a bug, then it went through the one of the agile teams that was actually like a maintenance team, and they were able to turn those bugs around, depending on the priority again, fairly quickly. So yeah, you can have, you know, your support team part of TFS and part of the whole process quite easily.
Yeah, so I think we need to do that more often. In the more critical customer facing, we definitely do involve them before releases. But getting them involved in TFS and maybe assigning them stuff so they know about it, they can look at the data, they can require or look at and know what's happening, I think is a great idea.
Do you get very many requests to actually modify the template? And if so, how do you handle those?
Say no. No, seriously, I mean, I always start with, okay, why are we changing what's there? Because depending on the size of the organization and the amount of money you want to throw at, any tool you put in, right, there's a cost to customization, there's a cost to support, there's a cost to upgrade. So, again, Scrum guy. If we're starting from Scrum, the Visual Studio Scrum template is extremely close to anything you would want to touch now in terms of Scrum. So you might want to add more reports. Sam, have you written one that day? Good.
No.
But actually changing the process itself, I would be sort of, you know, getting to the point of, you know, five whys, why, what's the root cause? Is it something we're doing wrong and we're trying to bend the tool to sort of support that? I mean, don't get me wrong, there's going to be perfectly valid times, but I would just tend to not start out as let's design a process and make the tool dance that way. Yeah, if we're taking something like Scrum, obviously there's industry-recognized CMMI, if that's kind of what your flavor is. I don't go in trying to say, now let's make the process changes. It's more about, well, understand your process, where you're trying to get to. Okay, if there's a gap, let's do some work. But it's something I try not to lead with, if you like.
I have to agree with Rob. Other than in situations where we've got clients that have, I'm not sure what the right word would be, but they're government agencies. So in Canada, they have to meet certain regulations in that, and they want and require that built into their process. And sometimes it's a customization of a work item. If they are doing that type of thing, I highly suggest that you find a person, consultant, whatever, to help with that, because it's easy to break the flow. In 2010, they've added a flow editor, so it's, you know, probably not as easy as it was in 2008, but it still can be very complex, and, you know, having someone know what they're doing is highly suggested.
Yeah, I would echo Rob saying we want to know why they want to change it. We put in a lot of work item types to kind of handle all the edge cases, like compliance for SOC stuff, deliverables, milestones, requirements, user stories. So we tried to cover all of the end cases, and through education, you know, we'll understand what their process is or why they want it, and then we'll say, maybe you can use this. This is kind of what this was intended for. But if it's a valid case, then, yeah, we would probably take it into consideration and add another work item type.
Yeah, so modifying process templates is very expensive if it goes beyond just adding a few more fields or attributes. So it only pays out if you have the opportunity to reuse this. And it's just not implementing the new process template, but you also need to maintain it. It must be evolvable. And yeah, that's something we're looking for support here from Microsoft. And what we did, we created something we call Siemens Solution Framework, a generic framework which adds more work item types to the Agile template, and but it's still generic enough that every software organization could use it, as long as they are willing to agree on those common terms. I found this a major obstacle, terminology. So is it a sprint or is it an iteration? So for us it's an iteration because it's the more neutral term, and if some hardcore agilists come in and say, can't you rename it to sprint? I can say yes, and I can calculate the cost of it, and then the discussion suddenly ends because it goes through everything, not only the work item types, the queries, the reports. It's really, really expensive. So you have to have somebody who knows what he or she is doing when you modify process templates.
One last question here.
Going back to the DevOps, so are you currently using any tools to keep track of that handoff from development to DevOps or to operations? So, for example, there's a feature that requires a bunch of network changes and a bunch of server changes. Are you using TFS to keep track of those, of that handoff, and to make sure that everything is documented? Or what are you doing about that?
So the teams I'm working with, those basic features or requests will go onto the ops team's backlog. So whether they're using, a Kanban approach, a Scrum approach, the delivery teams effectively will place items on their backlog, and they then get to see how that ranks in relative priority of all the other work out there. So, they're planning their sprint deliveries around, obviously, where they sit in the ops backlog as well. So both sides, hopefully the ops team can see what's coming out of delivery teams, and the delivery teams can see where the ops teams are at. And, yeah, TFS is great for them.
Short and sweet, I agree. TFS, work items, best way to handle it.
Unfortunately, we have an existing system in place, so we just record the kind of their reference number, and then, but in that system, it's very detailed as to what they're supposed to do, and then we get prior buy-off on when they're going to do it. But it would be nice to maybe incorporate that into TFS as well.
Yeah, so our ops have a different system too, but we are looking how to integrate this and just use TFS-based work items and workflows to handle both.
Great. Well, I think we're out of time, so I want to thank the panel members. I think it's great to get a rich set of perspectives. I think that Rob and Deborah and Michael and Martin will be here for the balance of the conference, and I encourage you to mingle and, feel free to go have, side conversations, talk to them about their experiences. So join me in giving them a big hand, and thanks for...